In politics, people often tell you not to get lost in the weeds. The Weeds from Vox is a podcast for people who love the weeds, because that's where politics becomes policy, the stuff that shapes your life and the lives of the people you care about. Every week, Matthew Iglesias is joined by a variety of leading Vox voices and policy experts to dig into the weeds on critical issues. It's a podcast if you want to get lost in the weeds, or if you just want to keep current with politics. Subscribe to The Weeds for free right now in your favorite podcast app to get new episodes automatically from Vox and the Vox Media Podcast Network. For some people, the pandemic has not been a surprise. We had a dress rehearsal with the SARS virus in 2003.
That really was our wake-up call. That virus was stopped from truly going pandemic. It wasn't quite as good at spreading.
This time, COVID-19 is good at spreading, and doctors have been caught off guard by unusual symptoms far beyond cough or fever.
Conjunctivitis or a pink eye, and even sort of tearing, a lot of tearing of the eyes.
Also today, Belarus is clamping down on the internet. When that happens, experts who are watching say it's a bad sign.
Human rights abuses, arbitrary detentions, brutality against citizens.
I'm Marco Werman, and those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to be with you. The sun has set in Belarus, and people again have taken to the streets. They're protesting the highly contested election of Alexander Lukashenko, a president who's been in power for almost three decades. Katya Glod is just outside the capital, Minsk. She's an analyst with SIPA, the Center for European Policy Analysis.
Over the past several days, we have seen many protests in Minsk and across Belarus. We have seen unprecedented violence from the side of the authorities. They used rubber bullets, they used water cannons, they also used stun grenades. And yesterday, for the first time, they used even live ammunition bullets. Many people have been arrested. Over 7,000 people, I think, are currently being arrested. Mm-hmm. They're held not in very good conditions. In other words, people are very angry, people are very frustrated, and people are very scared as well.
Do you personally know people who've been arrested or people who've been in custody and released?
Yes, I know many people who have been arrested. Some of my friends, for example, are being arrested. I know one family of my friends, for example, the wife has a diabetes, and for 2 days, her family, she and her husband, have been arrested when they came to one of the police stations in Minsk to take home their son, who they had been told was kept at the police station because he was one of the protesters. Their son is only 16 years old. And when they came to this police station, they got arrested themselves. The wife has a diabetes, and her lawyer has been denied information by the police authorities where the wife is kept. And basically, up until now, for 2 days, she cannot get hold of the medicine that she needs to take on a daily basis.
So President Alexander Lukashenko, does he have the police and the military on his side? And if he does, for how long?
Yes, President Lukashenko does have the military and the police on his side. President Lukashenko's campaign was focused on visiting military bases, on visiting riot police forces across the country. Also, the regime of Alexander Lukashenko is known for investing quite a lot of resources, financial resources, into the so-called Siloviki security services. These people are very well paid, and they are really brainwashed, and their superiors tell them that it's actually President Lukashenko who pays them salary.
What was your reaction when you found out that opposition candidate Svetlana Tikhanovskaya had fled the country?
I think the majority of the people who voted for Mrs. Tikhanovskaya, they support her decision. They don't regard it as fleeing the country. They understand that she did it under great pressure. There was accounts of the members of her campaign team who accompanied her to the Central Election Commission, where she was met with several security services officers who kept her for 7 hours, who threatened her with torture, as we now know from the Lithuanian foreign minister, Mr. Linkevičius, who said that in his interviews, because Lithuania accepted Mrs. Tikhanovskaya and gave her a visa, this is where she is now, people in Belarus who voted for Mrs. Tikhanovskaya think that she successfully completed her mission. She always admitted she was not a politician, yet she managed to mobilize the crowds behind her. People believe that she is now their president. So as such, the view of Tikhanovskaya leaving the country is actually quite positive, because people think that she will be safe and she can be more useful for the country being outside of Belarus.
Katya, are you satisfied with the reaction from the global community, considering the brink that Lukashenko seems to have taken Belarus to?
I appreciate the reaction of the EU and the current reaction of the US, that we have seen also a statement from Mike Pompeo.
We watched an election that we were very concerned about. It wasn't held in a way that was free and fair. We care about that because we care deeply about the Belarusian people.
I think all that is satisfactory. I think what people in Belarus would like to see as well, they would like the West to not consider President Lukashenko as a legitimate head of state. I think it's very emotional. People understand this is not very realistic. But I think that what people in Belarus would prefer, they would prefer more contact with Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, recognizing her as a legitimate authority, as a legitimate elected voice of the people in Belarus, rather than President Lukashenko.
Katya Glod is a Belarus analyst with the Center for European Policy Analysis, speaking with us from just outside Minsk. Katya, thank you for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
We were able to speak with Katya because the internet is now working off and on in Belarus. But as the world's Lydia Emanuelidou reports, monitoring groups say Belarusian authorities are clamping down on the internet. The intent? Prevent people from organizing and sharing information.
Alp Toker and his team at NetBlocks, that's an internet shutdown monitoring group, noticed the disruptions early on Sunday, election day in Belarus.
Our observatory first detected network incidents at midnight before the elections.
Then, as polls began to open around 8 o'clock in the morning, social media platforms started to go down. People couldn't access Facebook, Twitter, and other platforms. Toker says initially most of the disruptions were happening in the country's capital, Minsk.
This progressed, and as polls were being counted in the afternoon, things took a turn for the worse. Large parts of internet connectivity started to collapse. Many users were unable to get online.
Much of the country has been offline since. Mobile internet is being throttled. Popular social media platforms and messaging apps are disabled. Independent news sites are blocked. Phone lines are disrupted. Hanna Lyubakova is an independent journalist in Belarus.
This level of repression is unprecedented. The internet was shut down before, but to this extent, it never happened.
Lyubakova was speaking during a virtual panel organized by the Atlantic Council think tank yesterday. Her phone line connection was unstable, and she was hard to hear. At one point during the panel, she was asked a question about the future of independent online news media in Belarus.
Do you see signs that those amazing websites are going to be able to keep doing what they were doing? Oh, hello, not hearing you. Hanna, are you there?
The connection with Hanna disconnected, sorry.
Monitoring groups say this kind of internet interference is a telltale sign of government-imposed information blockades. Authorities in Belarus blame foreign forces for the internet and phone disruptions, and they say cyber attacks are partly to blame. But security experts say no, this is a tactic authoritarian governments are increasingly using to crush opposition.
This year alone, we've seen internet shutdowns around elections in Togo, Burundi, and Guinea.
Felicia Antonio is with Access Now, another organization that tracks shutdowns, and not just election-related ones. This year alone, they've tracked more than 53 incidents of governments shutting and slowing down the internet or blocking access to certain websites and apps. And what happens next is disturbing.
Whenever internet shutdowns happen in a country, we receive reports of human rights abuses against ordinary people, arbitrary detentions, physical assault, brutality against citizens.
Activists in Belarus say this is precisely why the government imposed internet restrictions, to prevent people from sharing evidence of brutal violence against protesters and to keep people from organizing. But in Belarus, some are finding workarounds. Many people are using the messaging app Telegram to get information and communicate. The app recently added special features for users in Belarus so they can circumvent the restrictions. A channel or group run by the independent news organization Nexta has amassed more than 1.5 million subscribers. They send out videos of demonstrations. There's a stream of photos and updates. Today, the channel was filled with messages urging people to turn out this evening and block the streets of Belarus. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
Joe Biden finally made the call. He's choosing Senator Kamala Harris of California as his running mate. Harris represents a few firsts as a vice presidential candidate. Her father was an immigrant who came to the U.S. from Jamaica. Her mother emigrated from India. Joining me now is Christina Newman Scott. She's a president of BRIC, the multidisciplinary arts organization in Brooklyn. Like Kamala Harris, Christina, you have family ties to Jamaica and India. There was a writer on Twitter today who posted, quote, "What a time to be black and Indian right now. I don't even know where to begin," end quote. So let me ask you, what is it like to be Jamaican and Indian today in the U.S.?
I mean, it's pretty amazing, quite frankly. We are so full of pride. And obviously, I know that all of my Indian family is also taking a lot of pride in saying, you know, things like that. You know, she gets her spirit from us, but it's almost like we've won a major global contest in some way. You know, my daughter, who is 10, she sees herself. Not only do we see ourselves because we're black women and Kamala is a strong black woman, but, you know, my daughter is very proud of her black and Indian heritage. And so even at 10 years old, she thinks it's possible for her to become the president of the United States. And that's very powerful and meaningful. Mm.
Have you heard from family and friends yet in Jamaica?
Oh my gosh. Well, first of all, it's my WhatsApp that's blowing up because all of us use WhatsApp like crazy. Everybody from, you know, sound like, you know, people like doing bap, bap, bap to, you know, my girl that, so, you know, that's how Jamaicans do it. You know, we can't stop the yard of them. Like all of that is happening.
What do you hope to hear from Senator Harris on the campaign trail?
Really just being centered in humanity, caring for one another in this country. I think this is a beautiful country. And I think that they will remind us of the beauty and spirit of all the people that make America the wonderful place that we get to live in. And I also know that she's not a quitter, she's a fighter. And so I'm ready to see how she will bring it when people try to take her to task. She is, as we say in Jamaica, little but chitalawa. She might look petite, but she's got a lot of fire there. And she's such a brilliant mind as well. I'm just looking forward to watching her.
There is a lot of pressure and unfairness that is forced on people who are the first. What are you concerned about as Kamala Harris goes back out on the campaign trail now with Americans really struggling around racial justice?
Yeah, the first is definitely hard. I think that let's just not get in our own way. Right? Like, I think that we're incredibly harder on women than we are on men. We are that much harder on black women. And I think that we should start from a place of imagining what's possible rather than dissecting and critiquing what might not be there in this time. Sometimes it becomes even a negative that's used against you, right? Like you're trying to create space for yourself that is somehow like, I don't know, is special, even though it's just facts, right? So I think that we just gotta give ourselves a break. My toddler's in the background.
It's working from home. This is the way it goes, right?
This is how it goes. They're singing.
Christina Newman Scott is the president of the multidisciplinary arts organization BRIC, speaking with us from Brooklyn. Christina, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Marco. It's great to chat with you.
Just ahead on the show, COVID toes and getting kids to be comfortable with masks. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. When the coronavirus first emerged, we were warned about some basic symptoms.
We were really looking out for the classic symptoms of respiratory viruses. We were looking for fever, cough, shortness of breath.
That's Dr. Andrew Chan, an epidemiologist here in Boston at Massachusetts General Hospital. As the virus spread, it became clear that the symptoms were way more complicated than what Dr. Chan just listed. Chan has been collaborating with colleagues in Europe to gather data on the full spectrum of symptoms. They created an app called Symptom Tracker to capture data from hundreds of thousands of participants in the U.S. and Europe, almost in real time. And the symptoms those patients report are surprising.
Well, they vary quite a bit. I think that's really been the lesson that we've learned. One example is loss of taste and smell, which is something that we identified very early on with the app. Probably upwards to 60% of people present with that symptom.
So loss of taste and smell, that's one thing. But what have you been learning about the main COVID-19 symptoms to look out for? And what are some of the more unusual ones?
Yeah, so the main symptoms appear to be loss of taste and smell and also fatigue. I think there's definitely a group of patients that present with very profound fatigue. And then finally, cough and then maybe fever. I think those are sort of the four primary symptoms that a lot of patients present with. But we are becoming more aware of more unusual symptoms that are also becoming important to look out for. That includes unusual skin rashes. We've seen increasingly unusual eye findings, for example, or other respiratory symptoms like chest tightness.
Did you say eye findings?
For example, red eyes or sort of a conjunctivitis or a pink eye, and even sort of tearing, a lot of tearing of the eyes. And sometimes that also coincides with neurologic symptoms like headaches.
I gather some of those skin rashes manifest as blisters on toes.
Yeah, so this is a very interesting also type of skin lesion that people are describing called COVID toes, which may reflect a later manifestation of COVID. So even after a few days of infection or maybe even beyond that, when people have recovered from infection, there have been changes noted in people's lower extremities where their toes look a little bluish or discolored. And that could reflect, you know, not necessarily a direct effect of the virus, but may also reflect immune or vascular problems as a result of an infection. So that's also unusual symptoms that people are now looking out for.
So, Dr. Chan, we're half a year into this pandemic. Have you been able to zero in on long-term symptoms?
The last few months have also taught us that there's a substantial proportion of people, including about 10 to 15% of people on the app, who report lingering symptoms. These are, you know, chronic symptoms that do leave people sometimes, you know, quite debilitated.
As I said, Dr. Chan, you're tracking all of this through your Symptom Tracker app, crowdsourcing people's experiences in several countries, the U.S. versus the U.K., for example. Are you finding differences in symptoms based on location?
Overall, the symptoms that people are reporting do seem to be relatively consistent across the countries. We've been also interested not only in the symptoms, but also what are the risk factors. We've been, for example, collecting data from healthcare workers and have found some differences between the countries in terms of risk of, for example, getting infected with COVID-19 related to how much access they've had to personal protective equipment. Most recently, we found that healthcare workers of color, in particular, were at higher risk of developing COVID-19, not only compared to the general community, but also other healthcare workers that were white. So I think those are important and really disturbing trends that we're picking up in the data that I think have really started to raise people's level of concerns in the public health community.
Dr. Andy Chan of Mass General Hospital here in Boston and lead on the COVID symptom study. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Masks, of course, are essential to stopping the spread of COVID-19. At the beginning of the pandemic, a couple in Texas had a hard time convincing their daughter to wear one. KERA's Alejandra Martinez tells us how this problem led the parents to write a bilingual children's book.
At Latinx birthday parties, there's a special moment kids wait for. And it's not the birthday cake. It's gathering around La Piñata to be the next in line to hit it. For 7-year-old Natalia Jaime Samaniego, this moment used to scare her a little. She didn't like covering her eyes with a blindfold.
She has always been scared of that. So all of a sudden, having to see that people had to wear masks was something very scary for her.
That's her mother, Marta Samaniego Calderon. They live in Denton, Texas, near Dallas. Samaniego Calderon says when the pandemic started, her daughter Natalia was afraid to wear a mask.
La máscara para mí se sentía muy como no quiero usar una máscara y toda la gente tenía máscara y yo estaba como no.
Little Natalia says she saw others were wearing masks, but she still didn't want to.
Yo no quiero usar máscara.
Samaniego Calderon knew she wasn't the only parent having conversations about COVID-19 with their kids. So she and her husband, Dan Hyman, decided to write a book. It's called Behind My Mask, or Detrás de mi Cubrebocas. This is her husband, who's also a professor of bilingual education at the University of North Texas in Denton.
I think it's really important as educators, as parents, that we really address what kids are feeling in terms of their emotions and their identities.
The book follows a young Latina as she tries on masks. She shares her emotions about them in both Spanish and English. Each mask in the book is illustrated to mean something.
The first mask is making reference to the essential workers. And the second mask is the monarch butterfly, and that's the undocumented community.
Samaniego Calderon did the drawings for the book. She says it was important to her to represent these groups. She's from Veracruz, Mexico. The monarch butterfly is a symbol for migration. It resonates with her. Masks save lives, but Marta points out they can also make it harder for people, especially those who have experienced racism, to determine if a space is safe.
With the current political times we're living in, for me it's very important to read people's emotions and faces and gestures.
The Texas couple hopes the book gives kids an opportunity to talk about the current political climate. At the end of the book, there are blank pages where children can draw their own mask. As a family, they recently drew one for Black Lives Matter.
Yo me siento muy triste porque las personas tienen COVID-19. No puedo ver a mi team de soccer.
As for little Natalia, she says she's still sad people are getting sick with the coronavirus. But the book has helped.
Mamá me estaba diciendo que tenemos que usar una máscara y... Porque el libro que hicieron me inspiró a que use una máscara.
She says the book has been an inspiration. And now she wears a mask. For the world, I'm Alejandra Martinez in Denton.
The book is Behind My Mask, or Detrás Cubrebocas. You can find more details at theworld.org. You tune into The World to stay on top of global news. Get an additional hit of news from The World in your email inbox. Subscribe to our morning newsletter, Top of the World. Just head to our website for details. That's theworld.org/newsletters. The U.S. and China, the tension between them is a fierce economic and political competition. So who's really on top?
The answer to the question, has China won, is... no, or more accurately, not yet.
That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH Boston and PRX. This week, we're focusing on global security threats, ones that look pretty different from traditional warfare. Lacey Healy with the national security podcast Things That Go Boom has been our guide. Today, Lacey examines how the past 30 years has seen China rise as a global power and especially recently seen the U.S. stumble. Here again is Lacey Healy.
For a lot of the world, the U.S. response to coronavirus has looked like a shambles. Not long after the virus hit our shores, medical workers were left begging for thermometers, body bags, and masks, using trash bags as makeshift gowns. And the whole thing reinforces this idea that was already out there, that the United States is falling behind. The pandemic has shown that the world's supposed superpower hasn't been able to handle its own crisis. It highlights for much of the world, and especially for America's adversaries, that despite this whole idea of American exceptionalism, the U.S. has some deep-seated problems that go way beyond coronavirus.
It's your roads, it's your bridges, it's your schools.
Kishore Mahbubani is a political scientist and former president of the UN Security Council. And he's been thinking a lot about this debate. In his new book, he asks us to consider a simple question. Has China won?
Today, if you want to experience a third world airport, you go to Kennedy Airport in New York.
Yes, American airports have their problems, like the alligator found wandering through Chicago's O'Hare. Yes, the American...
Or you can take the train from Boston to New York, which is considered the fast train. And it's amazing how bad it is, you know?
By international standards, the Acela is a little tragic. In 2015, its average speed clocked in at 68 miles per hour. And our airports aren't much better.
And if you want to experience a first world airport, you go to Beijing or Shanghai. And if you want to take a fast train, you take the fast train from Shanghai to Beijing, which I have taken, which goes to 700 kilometers an hour.
Here's a detail that my four-year-old would love. The train from Shanghai Airport doesn't even touch the tracks. It hovers over them on a magnetic buffer. At almost 270 miles per hour, it's the fastest commercially operated train in the world.
You know, in the same period where China has invested so much in building up its physical infrastructure and its intellectual infrastructure, America has not been making the same investments.
America, he's saying, get dressed, because China was up at dawn. Mahbubani says just a few short decades ago, the U.S. looked a whole lot friendlier and shinier to China. In fact, Southeast Asia looked up to the U.S. as a leader and a game changer. Mahbubani says his own life is a perfect example. He grew up in Singapore.
Well, you know, we live in a relatively poor neighborhood. There were six of us living in a one-bedroom house. We're paying a rent of about $6 a month. But the reason why I succeeded is that as a child, I discovered a small public library about a kilometer from my house. And I began borrowing books and reading books in English, written by very distinguished Western authors. And I realized the reason why Asia is rising now is that the West has been very generous with a gift of Western wisdom to the rest of the world, especially the gift of Western reasoning. And that is now spreading through the rest of the world and is lifting up the lives of lots of millions and billions of poor people in the same way that my life was uplifted by Western wisdom.
Mahbubani is referring to the Western brand, free markets, entrepreneurship, good governance. But he says today, the U.S. is not always seen as an exceptional Western country. China, meanwhile, is ascendant. And for some, the coronavirus put an exclamation point on this shift. China did suppress early warnings about the disease, and there were other missteps. But the U.S. also struggled.
So you're talking about 2.2 million deaths. And so if we could hold that down, as we're saying, to 100,000, it's a horrible number. And so we have between 100 and 200,000. We all together have done a very good job.
Mahbubani says the writing was on the wall, though, decades ago. And he points to one event in particular as a big blinking neon signpost. November of 1991.
Astonishing news from East Germany, where the East German authorities have said, in essence, that the Berlin Wall doesn't mean anything anymore. The wall that the East Germans put up in 1961 to keep its people in will now be breached by anybody who wants to leave.
He says the news was intoxicating, but in a kind of literal way. It left the U.S. drunk with a sense of triumphalism and hubris.
You know, I happened to be in Harvard in 91, 92, and I was shocked to discover how arrogant many American intellectuals had begun. And of course, they had all, I guess, as you say, inhaled the smoke from Francis Fukuyama's famous essay, The End of History, which said that all of humanity had come to an end of history and there's only one path for the world to follow, which was to become carbon copies of Western liberal democratic societies. And of course, for 1800 out of the last 2000 years, the two largest economies of the world have always been those of China and India. So the last 200 years of Western domination have been an enormous historical aberration. And that essay, as I've argued many times, did tremendous brain damage to the West because it put the West to sleep at precisely the moment when China and India decided to wake up.
The other flashpoint comes 12 years later, in 2001. And this one kind of slips under the radar.
If a historian is writing the history of the world 1,000 years from now, and if you are asked to say what were the most significant events that happened, right, as the third millennium began, he would point to China's joining of the WTO. Because when China joined the World Trade Organization, it suddenly injected about 900 million, that's three times the population of the United States, into the global capitalist system. And amazingly, there was an remarkable degree of complacency.
Basically, Mabubani is saying America just didn't adapt fast enough to the cheaper Chinese labor, outsourced jobs, and increased competition.
America thought, we have won. We can just go coasting on. We don't have to change or adjust. Of course, Europe did the right thing and invested a lot in retraining of its workers. America didn't do so at all. And the consequence is that over a 30-year period between 1980 and 2010, America became the only major developed country where the average income of the bottom 50% went down. And that's a perfect example of what happens when you go to sleep. The people suffer.
I want to circle back to China just a little bit during those same 30 years. If you can just compare and contrast how life is changing during those 30 years for the average Chinese citizen versus the average American citizen.
Well, I first went to China in 1980. And when I went there, China was still a very traditional communist country, even though it was gradually opening up. And the Chinese people were not allowed to choose where to live, what to wear, where to study, where to work. And certainly the Chinese were not allowed to travel overseas as tourists. Today, the same Chinese have the freedom to choose where to live, where to work, what to wear, what to study. And each year, 134 million Chinese leave China freely. And guess what? 134 million, which is more than one-third the population of the United States, goes back to China freely. So if China was still the dark communist gulag, would 134 million Chinese go back to China? So clearly something fundamental has changed in China, and America hasn't understood that change.
To be fair, some Chinese are more free than others. Since early 2017, the government has engaged in the de-extremification of up to a million Uyghurs, Kazakhs, and other ethnic minorities, forcing them into internment camps in Xinjiang. And religious figures, intellectuals, academics, and others are regularly detained for speaking out against the government. And Americans have sort of historically and even now had a hard time wrapping their minds around China. And one of the ways that that manifests today is that they really can't understand how many Chinese people are supportive of their government. Can you speak a little bit to that?
You're right. I mean, they cannot understand the fact that even though China lives in a country run by the Communist Party of China, the Communist Party of China has delivered a far greater improvement in the lives of ordinary Chinese than any previous Chinese government has done in 3,000 years. So if you are a very poor Chinese who had experienced famines, who didn't have enough to eat, who couldn't send his children to school, who had to struggle with a basic income, suddenly the last 30 years have been the best 30 years ever in Chinese history. And then you say, why should I change my government? You know? But I think many of the American reactions to China are not driven by any rational calculations, but driven by a deep emotional undercurrent, a deep fear and distrust of what is called the yellow race. And that also explains, in many cases, why many Americans fail to understand China, because they cannot even conceive of the possibility that a society like China could thrive and do well.
If the U.S. failed to see what was coming its way when China joined the WTO in 2001, it's probably worth mentioning that there was something else happening that year, something that had nothing to do with China.
We understand that there has been a plane crash on the southern tip of Manhattan.
A plane has crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center.
Oh, my God. Another plane has just hit.
After 9/11, the U.S. embarked on a series of expensive wars in the Middle East that have punctuated all of our lives.
I think sometimes the point is made that 9/11 distracted the United States from China's rise. But I think that's actually the wrong lesson to be learned.
That's Rachel Esplin-Odell. She's a research fellow in the East Asia program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, and she's also an international security fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School.
The mistake was that we tried to use military force to bend the world to our will, and that U.S. officials distorted intelligence and manipulated claims about Iraqi WMDs in ways that misled the American people and enabled the Bush administration's rush to war against Iraq. And so the risk is that that's what the Trump administration is doing in this present moment, where they're releasing claims about the origins of this virus that seem to imply that China did this in some malicious way.
And Mr. Secretary, have you seen anything that gives you high confidence that it originated in that Wuhan lab?
Martha, there's enormous evidence that that's where this began.
And that it's responsible for all the death and suffering that's taking place in the United States.
I would like to begin by announcing some important developments in our war against the Chinese virus.
But it's not just the U.S. China's been at it, too.
The theory that the U.S. started the virus is mainstream in China.
Government-controlled Xinhua tweeted an animation further mocking the U.S.'s blaming of China.
Are you listening to yourselves?
We are always correct, even though we can't...
When Americans are experiencing a lot of fear and uncertainty, that can provide an opening for people who want the United States to pursue a more hostile or zero-sum approach to foreign relations to push their agendas. And that's where we stand in this moment. So that risks pushing us into a Cold War with China.
And the consequences of war aren't just in lives lost, though lives could certainly be lost. Mabubani says, look again at 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq. Look how much that cost us.
Some economists have predicted that America may have wasted $3 trillion on that conflict. And if you can imagine the $3 trillion being spent on the American people to provide health, education, and jobs instead of fighting an unnecessary war, the American people would have been much, much better off today. And it was a completely unnecessary war because America accomplished nothing. And today, when America complains about Iranian influence in Iraq, very few Americans are aware that the main dam that was preventing Iranian influence from entering Iraq was Saddam Hussein. And America broke the dam. And when America broke the dam, it was perfectly natural for Iran to recover its influence among the dominant Shiite majority in Iraq. And, you know, frankly, if you don't have a comprehensive global policy, it means that America is constantly giving geopolitical dividends to China. So I can tell you, if, for example, the United States ends up in a war with Iran, I wouldn't be surprised if the champagne pops in Beijing because they say, well done. America will now be distracted for another 10 years. In another useless war in the Middle East, and China will keep rising.
So
has China won?
Well, I think the answer to the question, has China won, is no. Or more accurately, not yet.
What can the U.S. begin to do to turn around the relationship? Do you have suggestions?
To put it very simply, if China was a company and America was a company and not a country, they would see the synergies between the two companies and they would immediately collaborate.
Rachel O'Dell's on board with that. She says the question isn't, has China won?
This isn't about trying to beat China. This is about trying to beat climate change. This is about trying to beat pandemics. If we both strive to win, then we could both end up losing.
It's not exactly a crazy suggestion. Rachel pointed out that the U.S. and China have worked together in the past, like during the SARS outbreak in 2003. Afterward, they even came up with 10 core principles of global pandemic response. But today, the U.S. is so worried about competition, it can't be bothered to clean its own house. And the problem with that is, this isn't the last global crisis we're going to face. For The World and Things That Go Boom, I'm Lacey Healy.
Things That Go Boom is a podcast about national security from PRX and Inkstick Media. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. Ruth Morris produced today's story. Tomorrow, Lacey picks up the reporting, looking at the darker side of China's rise, its tilt to authoritarianism and nationalism. Every day, this pandemic shakes us with new numbers, new discoveries, and uncertainty about the future. If you want a summation of what we've been through so far, science journalist Deborah McKenzie has just published one of the first comprehensive books on the coronavirus, COVID-19, The Pandemic That Never Should Have Happened and How to Stop the Next One. So for this book, you write that this pandemic has not exactly been a surprise. What's been the timeline in your view, the kind of noteworthy events that led up to this?
It all really crystallized in 2002, 2003, when the SARS virus went on a bit of a global excursion. And that really was our wake-up call. That virus was stopped from truly going pandemic. It got to a bunch of different countries and gave a few cities, notably Toronto in Canada, a bad time. But it wasn't quite as good at spreading. So there was an amazing sort of world effort led by the WHO at the time, and they managed to stamp it out and stop it from getting a permanent foothold. But that was the point at which it became obvious that, well, firstly, that we really weren't ready for this, and secondly, that it could happen any time and could be very bad.
And what parallels do you see between SARS and what we're facing now with COVID-19?
Virologists named the COVID-19 virus SARS-2. That pretty much tells you what you need to know. It's very similar. It's the same family of viruses. It uses the same molecule on the surface of human cells to invade the cell. It's very similar. We could, at that point, have just kept working on coronavirus drugs and vaccines. We started, obviously, being scared by this, to do some pretty good work on it, and we could have kept going. But for some reason, all the funding agencies decided, well, no, we got rid of SARS, right? That's not a threat anymore. Let's stop.
Why was that? And given what we knew about SARS, I mean, how were governments and countries preparing for the next one?
There were just some theories that, you know, it was a one-off. It had strange mutations, and that wasn't likely to occur with viruses in the wild again, and they hadn't found it, and they hadn't done a very good job of looking for it in wild animals. And, you know, basically everybody just thought, okay, well, that was a close one, and decided they could, you know, pay attention to other more obvious threats instead.
Deborah, we're in the midst of a pandemic that has turned the world upside down. It's devastated communities. Honestly, it's traumatic and hard to take in day after day. It can feel like a fog. What are the things that you're trying to ensure get remembered?
We clearly need far more transparency among nations on the matter of outbreaks on their territory. Right now, under the existing international treaty governing disease outbreaks that might have an international significance, national sovereignty is absolute. When, you know, China said, we've got this outbreak, but it's not spreading between people. And I know a lot of virologists were kind of skeptical about that from the start. And they couldn't say, well, that's nice. Could we come in and talk to your doctors? But we didn't, because the WHO didn't have that power. People are saying, oh, well, the WHO didn't tell us the one thing we needed to know. It let the world community down. No, it didn't know. It didn't have the power to go into China and inspect its disease declaration and see whether it was likely to have been true or not. And we need that.
Last year, a month before the first cases of COVID-19 appeared in Wuhan, Johns Hopkins, as you know, ran a pandemic simulation featuring a fictitious virus that was nearly identical to COVID-19. Preparedness was discussed. So how can things turn out better next time?
We're very bad at low probability, high consequence events. When you're deciding how to spend a budget, you say, we could have a pandemic next year. We'd better lay in all sorts of supplies. Well, will we have a pandemic next year? Well, nobody can tell you that. You know, we might not. And what you know you're going to have next year is all sorts of things that you have to spend a certain limited government budget on. So it just doesn't get spent on. This is it. Well, now we've had a real world situation. Now government people and all the others know that we face a very serious situation if we don't do more planning and preparation for this kind of thing. Hopefully, we will get commitment at the highest levels politically to actually fund platforms for keeping this kind of preparation going and for having the kind of international collaboration on surveillance and verification of what's going on with diseases in the world.
Science journalist Deborah McKenzie has covered infectious diseases for decades at The New Scientist and is author of the new book, COVID-19, the pandemic that never should have happened and how to stop the next one. Deborah, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Last week's tragic blast in Beirut has haunted its people in Lebanon and beyond. There's a song that conjures up the mixed emotions many Lebanese are feeling. It's called simply Beirut. It's originally from the 1930s, but was revived and updated 7 years ago by the Lebanese singer Yasmin Hamdan. She lives in Paris now, but the song and the city are never far from her thoughts, especially now.
It actually portrays a little bit the relationship we have with the city. We love it, and we are, I mean, I have seen it destroyed three times in my life, and it's painful. And so it talks about that, this mix of despair and hope, this mixture of love and hate, and kind of a karma that we've been living forever with this country and this city.
So the first part of the song Beirut, you sing nostalgically about the city. What are some of the images that you conjure?
In the chorus, when it says Beirut, a flower, and at the end, then it says that it's dying somehow, or it's such a pity that it fades.
You talk about Beirut being a flower out of its terrain, her beauty, that's the good old days. So Beirut now, it's kind of got a bitter takeaway to it.
I mean, bitterness was always there, but it was mixed feelings. But yeah, I mean, I left the country maybe 15 years ago because I had no hope that these people in power would ever step down. And because I saw their vulgarity, I saw the corruption and how they managed to divide people. And I decided to leave. But it's also difficult because you leave and you leave your memories behind you. You leave your family, you leave your friends, you leave your part of your heart stays there.
Yasmin, is there an image of Beirut that you kind of keep by your side to turn to give yourself hope?
The sea. The sea is really beautiful. The colors, yeah. This is what I love most, the colors, the sea, the sky. It's a very beautiful city.
And that's where we leave you today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston. Hope to have you back with us tomorrow.